Audio.
I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. Hey, and like always, I appreciate the five of you actually listening to me for the 90 minutes of fun that I have with my guests. And I just want to remind everyone that we are less than 30 days out from The Rugged Life hitting shelves. You can pre-order that everywhere books are sold. And, you know, basically The Rugged Life is the answer to the pandemic. I hate to use that example, but if there's one thing we learned is how much we don't know how to do. And we relied on technology way too much to have food and coffee delivered to our front doors. So The Rugged Life basically is, if you are just a little more self-reliant, then, you know, global crisis emergencies will not impact you as much. So try to be as self-reliant as possible. And then you kind of create a bubble of skills that prevent the outside world from messing with you and your daily life and your family's lives. So check out The Rugged Life. It's available everywhere books are sold for pre-order and will be on shelves May 10th. Today, we have a successful investment banker, the creator of Project 7 for Soldiers, founder of Dawson's Peak Foundation, a avid traveler with 35 plus countries under his belt, and a licensed motorcycle racer. Matt Dawson, or Dawson, welcome to the show, buddy.
Hey, man, I appreciate you having me, Clint. Thank you very much.
Not a problem. So like always, I start with a little bit of rapid fire where I'm going to give you two choices. You pick one, and then we'll circle back around and you explain the why. Are you ready?
All right. I'll see what I can do.
Okay. Planes or trains?
Planes.
What about subways? Have you heard about the subways these days?
I tell you, from what I hear, I'd rather be 20,000 feet in the air than 200 feet below the ground right now.
Yeah, man, it's unfortunate. Okay, the train or automobile?
Oh, automobile, 100%.
Automobile, yeah. I figured that'd be your answer. You're just staying away from trains completely. That's a good idea. Okay, mergers or acquisitions?
Acquisitions, 100%.
And then I have to. I mean, I'm a fan of American Psycho. So, what was the other option? It's murders and amputations.
Oh, murders and executions.
Murders and executions. So, which one would you pick on that one?
I think it depends on my mood.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I'll circle murder. Pistol or rifle?
Oh, that's a good one. I'd say rifle.
Rifle. Okay, we'll come back to why. All right. Polar. Okay, we'll say polar caps or deserts?
Deserts.
Deserts. The bottom of the ocean or the top of mountains?
Oh, easy. Top of mountain.
Top of mountain. And then what about desert versus mountain?
Ooh, that's tough. I'd probably go with mountain again.
Mountain again? Yep. All right. Okay, let's circle back to the top. We kind of discussed it. You picked a plane over a train. How many plane rides have you been on? Have you counted them?
I've been a licensed pilot for about 15 years now.
Oh, a pilot as well.
Yeah. So I've been a pilot for 15 years, had my, you know, I'm IFR rated. And so I've flown for some time and just absolutely love it. I don't get a chance to fly as often now as I'd like to, but it's something that's been a part of my life for a while now.
Yeah, I got my private pilot. I was at SEAL Team 3. I took 30 days of leave and I got back from a deployment and knocked it out, right? And this was pre-9/11 at Montgomery Field in San Diego. Yep. And that was like ultimate freedom, right? Once you're doing your solo at the 10-hour mark and your instructor gets out, you take off and you're on your own, that's when you realize just how crazy it is to let people just take a plane and fly. Because, you know, you're relying on everyone else to have their head on a swivel. And the more you fly, you start to realize that that's not always the case, right?
Exactly. Not 100%. But it's like you said, I love the freedom of it. And I love the consequence of it. Is often when I'm flying and maybe, you know, I'm only at, you know, 6,000-8,000 feet, you know, something like that, just flying around SoCal. And just it just dawns on me that I'm alone in a plane, 8,000 feet off the ground. You know, if I don't perform, that there's going to be a consequence to this. And that's something I really enjoy about it.
Yeah, you're right. The success and the failure reside solely on you.
It does. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you mentioned the motorcycle race, and that's another thing I enjoy about that. It just I enjoy things that have a consequence to them that require you to stay locked in and to perform.
Yeah.
And it just makes things more interesting.
No, I've got common ground with you there. And like you, I haven't been able to fly as much as I'd like to. And I started my instrument rating, but never finished it. You know, just, you know, the Navy got in the way, damn it. And then, yeah, motorcycles. So you brought it up. We might as well talk about it right now. You can't see them, but right there, there's three of them staring at me. You know, I kind of, every now and then I turn on the headlights and use it as studio lighting.
What do you have there? What do you have there with you?
I've got the S1000RR BMW.
Yep.
I've got an Indian Challenger for just cruising and long distance. And then for round town, I've got an Indian Bobber, the new Scouts.
Oh, nice. Now, yeah. I tell you, those Scouts are good looking bikes.
Yeah.
Wow, all the bikes you named are good looking bikes. That BMW is just a weapon right now.
Yeah, it's a rocket. It's a rocket ship. Yeah, but the Indians, I mean, especially the Scouts, I love they kept all the World War II kind of design, and that vintage cafe racer combined with history is just super cool.
Now, they've done a great job of kind of melding that Indian tradition with, you know, kind of a newer, updated version of it, but without losing that look and feel. They've done a wonderful job the past couple years on that.
Yeah, they're starting to just crush Harley. It's crazy.
They are. Yeah, I was looking at those because I go up to Laguna Seca every year for the races.
Yeah.
Used to be MotoGP, now it's World Superbike Moto America. And Indian always has a big presence there, so you get to, you know, see the bikes firsthand. And I've been really impressed with them recently.
Yeah. You know the joke that's going right now. You know the best place to buy a Harley?
Where is that?
At an Indian dealership. Because they're trading them in. Okay, let's see here. We had mergers and acquisitions. So you went with acquisitions. So give us a little bit about that.
Well, just, you know, on the acquisition side, it's you know, you're the one in control. Is that you've identified a target? You know, you see some benefit with acquiring that target. You see some way that either, you know, grow your operations into new territories or, you know, new products, new services, things like that. So just having the opportunity to identify a target and the ability to acquire that target also means that you're in a good, strong position. So there's just a lot of things going for you when you're able to do that.
So I'm guessing when you were doing that, you're making probably, I mean, you have to be, is this one of those fields you got to be in for a while before you really start making a lot of money, just like anything? Or were you cranking it out and decided, okay, I'm making great money, I'm just going to stop all this and start doing adventures?
You know, it's interesting. Is banking? It depends on kind of the part of banking that you're in. So with M&A, the first, you know, normally 2 to 3 years, you're working 80 to 100 hours a week, just absolutely, you know, killing yourself. And, you know, it's decent money for the industry. And then normally what you'll do is you'll go back and you'll go to business school and then come back out and get, you know, and just kind of stay involved. And then after a number of years is when you can start making more money. You know, to your point, is with the creation of Dawson's Peak, I've been in this field for 15 years. I really was beginning to enter the prime of my earning potential. And that's when I chose to walk away and to focus on the organization. Cause what I learned was, although I was successful from certain societal and business standards, is I had this sense of numbness and emptiness and kind of a lacking and longing inside of me. And yeah, I was successful enough to understand that no amount of money is going to plug that hole.
Right.
And I don't care how many motor. And look, I'm like you. I've got three bikes in the garage right now. And no matter how many bikes or cars or trips or dinners or clubs or whatever, if you've got that hole inside of you, it's not going to feel it.
Yeah.
So you know, I was able to you know, come up with Dawson's Peak, and I tell you what, I've never been more fulfilled. I've never felt more purposeful and never been happier in my life.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it takes a lot of courage to kind of pull the trigger, right? I mean, especially if you knew, wait a minute, I'm giving up all, because dollar signs are heavy, right? As far as when it comes to decision-making and to move away from them, to go fulfill a dream or chase down a passion. That's takes a lot of courage and balls to pull it off, right?
Well, I tell you, it's one thing to say you're going to do it, and it's another thing to do it. And then it's another thing to sit there and watch all your bank accounts just trending in the wrong direction, which is what I've been doing for a couple of years now. But, they say that money is not a true motivator. Yeah. It is in the sense that obviously we all need it to do certain things, but there's definitely a diminishing line of return when you're dealing with money. But then after a while, it's just, look, you hear about all these professionals, whether they're businessmen or women or professional athletes, that have all the money and the accolades in the world, and they're miserable. And they commit suicide or try suicide, things like that. So it's just, you got to make a decision for yourself about what's most important in your life. And with me is living with purpose and being fulfilled is more important to me than, the maximizing how much money I can make.
Yeah. Well, and if you can combine both, then that's a really good deal, right?
That's the plan right now. I'm working making this, attaching some money to it at some point.
Exactly. So we'll, man, I'm having a lot of fun, but I'm poor as fuck. But yeah, that's all right. Yeah. Okay, I'll make money some other way. We'll figure it out.
Thank God for later. Credit cards.
Yeah, I know the feeling. Yeah. I've done that once before. I just took a risk and it worked out. But man, it was on my credit card for a while before it finally got paid off. Okay, going back to our little list here. Rifle versus pistol. You picked rifle.
I knew you were going to bust me up on that one. I felt it coming. Normally I would say pistol because I like things that are up close and personal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's normally more my personality, but I tell you, I love long range distance shooting with rifles. That's kind of what I was thinking with rifle. Just, kind of sit there, maybe just kind of lay back in the weeds, pick something off from a couple hundred yards. And just, just kind of the skill that's involved with it.
Mm-hmm.
And just, the focus, everything that's kind of involved with that, that's something that really appeals to me.
Yeah, I can see that. There's something therapeutic about just long range shooting and kind of getting into the moment and remembering to pay attention to how you breathe. I mean, it's like
being present,
Right.
I had a friend that was that ran a gun range, and that's something that we would do sometimes. Just go out there, pull the truck up and just hit long range targets for hours, and it was just a lot of fun to lay out there. And like you said, you have to be so present. You have to be aware of yourself, your breathing, take everything into account, make the calculations, and that's just the strategy and the challenge behind it. I really enjoy.
Yeah, I can see that. That's awesome. Then we went with polar caps versus deserts. You picked desert.
Yeah.
Why is that?
It's even though I was born and raised in Alabama, I'm a desert rat. And I don't know what it is, but there's something about deserts that just call to me.
Huh.
And if you believe in past lives, I was definitely a desert nomad or something at some point, because I love being in hot, dusty, dry environments. And deserts, they're just so unforgiving in a lot of ways that you really have to be on your game. And if you take just a little one step off course, that can compound pretty quickly. So I enjoy that challenge of it. It's just a little more unforgiving a lot of times than mountains are.
Yeah. Yeah. You're definitely like me. You've got a little bit of that risk versus reward, and you'll always choose risk. Yeah, I totally get it. And what's interesting though, for us, you were obviously in the Navy, and we always had a saying, you can always put on enough to be warm, but you can never take off enough to cool down. Right.
Yep.
So deserts, you can get butt naked and you're still going to be hot as hell. Whereas in cold environments and cold weather warfare, you can get the layers on and you can actually be comfortable regardless of the temperature outside for the most part.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's why I was surprised by your desert answer, because most people be like, nope, can't take enough off. You're always hot, right?
Well, yeah, no, and look, I was born and raised in Alabama. So during the summers, we would have, two a days where it's 100 degrees, 100% humidity. So I can, you know, the heat is something I grew up with.
Yeah, two-a-days. That's your football kid then, right?
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Okay, next. Then I gave you desert versus mountains. That one you went with mountains, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That I got. It's tough, man. That's like picking between, you know, two girlfriends. That's a tough one there. But there's something about the mountains that for me are just magical. I think one of the biggest things, obviously, it's a very challenging, demanding environment. It's a very hard environment. You know, there's nothing soft about a mountain. But also it really puts into perspective how inconsequential we are as individuals.
Yeah.
Like when you walk through the Himalayas, for example, you understand, you know, kind of where you fit in the world and just how just, again, inconsequential that we all are. And that's something that appeals to me. I like being put in my place like that.
Yeah. And not to mention, I mean, it's just beautiful, right? I mean, I don't care what mountain. I've been on all the none of them are famous mountains, but they're all in, like, you know, hashtag shitholes. So, you know, and you can stand there and I don't care which country it was. You're just kind of like, holy shit, man, this is beautiful. You know,
it
mountain
is,
ranges are just beautiful.
They are. And it's just, I love the challenge of it as well, that if you need to go somewhere, it's not, you're not just walking, you know, in a flat surface for a mile. It's like, you may have to climb 5,000 feet.
Yeah.
And there's something about going vertical. That if your mind's not in the right place, I mean, it will just crush your soul. You know, if you're not prepared, and I've seen it. It's happened to me. I've seen it happen to people, and I like that.
Yeah, especially if you got like 60 plus pounds on your back.
Exactly.
That's when it really crushes your skull. Oh, boy. Okay, then we went, the bottom of an ocean. I kind of hit you with water, top of a mountain. So you still went with the top of the mountain.
I tell you, I did. It's just, it's as much as I like water, is I don't like being wet a lot of times. I'm a dry guy.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can deal with the snow and the sleet and all that, but you get me wet for too long. It's not something that I really dig too much. I bought a surfboard and a wetsuit and I took it out once and then, you know, gave it to a buddy. It just, I had enough.
That's very nice of you.
It was a nice gift. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Really. Yeah, I'm with you. You know, most seals will lie and say, I love the water. I love being cold. But I'm the first one to tell you, no, that's all bullshit. Most seals, especially, you know, I went 20 years and, you know, you come out of it like completely hydrophobic. You're like, fuck the water. I don't want to go near it ever again. And if it's not 150 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm not getting in. But yeah, I understand the wet equation. It sucks. We will be right back after the break. Hey, this is Clint Emerson, retired Navy SEAL. I get a lot of questions about my morning routine. So here it is in a nutshell. 5 a.m., wake up. First cup of coffee, I dump Bubs Naturals MCT oil in there. And then I mix it around with one of those little automatic stir spoon thingies that make it all frothy and creamy. And then my second cup, I dump Bubs Naturals collagen in there. Now, the reason I do both is the first one, MCT, fuels my brain. It gets me up, allows me to focus on whatever I've got going on. The second cup of coffee has collagen, which honestly, it's like lubrication for my joints. It makes my neck and my shoulders, my left hip and my left knee feel pretty damn good. And it wasn't until I went over to Australia that I realized that this stuff really does work. I was overseas for about 45 days, and in the first week, I wasn't so focused in the morning. In fact, I was a little foggy, and my neck was hurting, my shoulders were hurting, and I thought to myself, it's just jet lag, different pillow, a different mattress. And then it dawned on me, I don't have my Bubs with me. The day I got back to the States, I immediately started back up, and within a week of being home, I was focused again, my joints didn't hurt, and I was like, holy, I can tell you that Bubs Naturals works. Great for your skin and hair, by the way. Everything feels good. Unlike a lot of supplements out there, it actually works, and that's the key takeaway here. It works. I'm telling you. You will notice a difference. Check out BubsNaturals.com and order some MCT and collagen now. And don't forget to use promo code CANYOUSURVIVE. All right. Well, that was good. You see, now we got you all warmed up and get to know you a little bit. Let's go. Let's dive straight into the Project 7 for Soldiers and Dawson's Peak. And I'm seeing Lieutenant Dan here. Lieutenant Dan, yeah. Tell us all about that.
Yeah. So Dawson's Peak is a 501c3 that I started a few years ago. And our mission is to inspire the discovery and pursuit of individual purpose. It's basically to get people to recognize that we all have the ability, that we all have a unique gift that only we can offer the world in a way that only we can offer it. And that we have not only the capacity to identify and to offer that, but also the duty, because everything that we do is going to eventually impact everyone else. So we're all in this thing together. And to understand that we have a role and a responsibility in society, you know, not only for ourselves, but for everyone else. So what we do is that we create large scale global expeditions that are undertaken by athletes that we sponsor, where viewers can watch our athletes and to say, well, if this person's climbing a mountain or rowing an ocean, I can identify a mountain in my life or an ocean in my life, something that I feel is potentially greater than I am, something that scares me, something that I put off forever. And if I truly apply myself, you know, dedicate myself, that this is something that I can dress, overcome, conquer, you know, whatever that is. And to really use our athletes as a point of inspiration. So the current project that we're working on is our first project. It's called 7 for Soldiers, where I'm the guinea pig, is I'm trying to set 7 world records across a variety of activities that include completing the Explorer's Grand Slam, which means climbing the highest peak on each continent and then skiing to the North Pole, South Pole, and then flying a single engine plane around the world, trekking solo unsupported across the Mojave Desert and Death Valley, and then finally rowing across the Atlantic Ocean.
Damn.
So 100% of the net proceeds that we're raising, we're donating to our two charity partners on this, two additional charities, which is the Gary Sinise Foundation. So, you know, Lieutenant Dan tie in there.
Yeah.
And then Hope for the Warriors, and these are two of the highest rated veteran focused charities in the U.S. So we're extremely fortunate and grateful to be working with them on this. And Gary, as you know, is he and I have gotten much closer, you know, over the past couple of years working together. And he's just an absolutely unbelievable guy. And I feel like as much as I'm trying to do, every time I talk to him, I even feel worse about myself because he's just doing so much more for people. You know, I'm just trying to follow in his footsteps.
Wow, man. That sounds, I kind of want to go. How do we sign up? Is this something you could sign up for?
But I'll put you in my backpack. I'll take you with me.
Okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I don't mind being carried around. That'd be cool. I'll cheer you on though. I'll whisper in your ear. I'll just keep you going. I'll motivate you with sweet whispers. Yeah. And Gary, I mean, I think I met him once, but all my buddies, you know, obviously in the SEAL community that are involved in nonprofits, you can tell he's the real deal, genuine guy that bends over backwards to help out veterans, and he's gone to bat for him several times. So it's awesome, man. That is a great project, and everything you mentioned is everything I'm interested in as well. But and like you were saying, I just don't make time for it. I should. But okay. So next one, the 7 world records you mentioned. Wait, so you've already, actually, you've set 7 world records already, correct?
Or no, the attempt is to set 7. Currently, I have 1. So
okay, you have 1 out of the 7. Okay.
We have 1 out of the 7, exactly. So, and really, once this is all said and done, it may get up to 8. We're kind of seeing how things go, but we're sticking with 7 right now. Plus, the title just sounds better, 7 for Soldiers. But currently, yeah, I've got 1 under the belt and working on the rest. Unfortunately, as I should actually be in the North Pole right now, that got canceled with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. One of the big companies that helps run the North Pole is a Russian company.
Oh.
So because of that, the season got canceled, and the season's only about 3 weeks long each year at the end of March through like mid to late April.
Man.
So, we've got 1 more iron in the fire that we're working to try to get up there this year. But for the last 3 or 4 years, no one has been to North Pole. It's gotten canceled for various reasons, COVID, you know, and now Russia. So that's put a delay on a lot of this, but there's still a couple other things that we can do in the meantime.
So what was the one you've completed already that you set a record?
Yeah. So already this year, I've completed a number of the expeditions. Mm-hmm. So I've summited, the beginning of May 23 of last year. so we're a little, we're about what, 11 months into it, is I've summited Mount Everest, Denali, Kilimanjaro, Elbrus, Vinson, which is in Antarctica, Aconcagua, and then also I've skied to the South Pole.
Nice.
And then the one record that I have is I was the first person to cross the Mojave Desert in Death Valley solo, unsupported. So I did a crossing of 213 miles in 6 days, 23 hours.
6 days?
6 days, 23 hours. Pulling a 220-pound cart. And then, and yeah, that was an interesting one. I mean, that's where I kind of got the desert, you know, answers out of that one. And then recently, I just got back from rowing across the Atlantic Ocean. We rode 3,100 miles in 53 days, 3 hours and 30 minutes.
Damn, man. That's fast. That's 6 hour mark. I can relate directly to that. That's moving out 200 plus miles in 6 days.
Yeah, it was 213 in 6 days, 23 hours. So it comes out to just over 30 miles a day.
Yeah.
Something like that. And, you know, it was a good effort. I think I can do better. And, I may or may not be thinking about going back and putting some more miles on that and see if I can't do it a little bit faster.
Yeah.
But the tough part of that was on the second day is something happened and I think I kicked something with my left leg. And over the next couple of days, my lower left leg from my knee down just started getting more and more swollen to where it got about 50% larger, 60% larger than my right leg.
Hmm.
And it was really hindering my progress. It got to the point about the last 25 miles. You know, I thought my leg was going to split open. It was so swollen and so much pressure, right? Luckily I had a roll of duct tape with me and just duct taped the crap out of it from my knee to my ankle to finish that 20 something miles off.
Damn, man. Yeah. It sounds like my medical mind would have been like, I think I threw a clot, you know, like,
yeah, that was the concern. As soon as I got back, it's, I had a buddy who's a doctor take a look at it and he's like, yo, you need to go to the emergency room, like right now.
Yeah. Get on blood thinners.
I went there and I was in there for a couple hours. He did all the scans for clots and all this kind of stuff. And they came back with, it was some type of, bacterial infection.
Oh.
So I was on, yeah.
Wow.
I don't know how, because I had some broken skin and some scratches. So maybe just got infected somehow.
Crazy.
But it was one of those things where, like, yeah, if you'd have waited much longer, you know, this could have been a lot worse.
So are you hard or are you dumb? You know, because they say you better be hard or you better be dumb.
Yeah, I think sometimes it might be better just to be a little bit dumb. So yeah. I think I kind of skirt around that.
Well, and also I want to add for listeners, when he says 120-pound cart in 100 Deadly Skills Book 2, I actually outline this. It's all illustrated if you're not aware, Dawson. And it's basically an illustration of everyday carry for, you know, desert operations. And so you put everything on a cart and you can have harnesses or I don't know what you use, but basically you're pulling it behind you and it prevents you from having to carry so much directly on your back, pushing down on your spine.
Yep.
I'm curious. So did your cart, was it a single axle, double axle? Did you have multiple, did you have to change out the tires at all?
That's a great question. I'm impressed. That's a very good question. So it was a game cart that I just bought off the internet and, you know, for hauling game out of the woods.
Yeah.
And so it's a single axle. And then I went on to Amazon and I bought new bearings and bigger tires. And I put go flat or run flat tires on there.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to worry about, you know, blowing out and tubes and all that kind of stuff. And then what I did was the handle of it was just too short. Cause I use it generally kind of like a rickshaw where I stand inside of it and then pull it behind me. And then sometimes I'll stand out in front of it and pull it and, you know, pull the entire thing, the handle behind my back. But, then what I did was, is I had a guy to extend the handle on it. So the handle was about 2.5 feet. And I put another 2 feet on it and did some box steel, little quarter inch box steel, and just really kind of fortified it. And it worked well for me. And I'm actually in the process right now of kind of redoing it and rejiggering some ways of how to put my water on it, you know, where to just kind of create more efficient storage and utilization of the space. Because I think that's something that kind of slowed me down a few minutes here and there. Because in the beginning, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. I was using this, what I used in the mountains and on the poles, you know, for that. I learned a lot along the way. So when I go back, I think I could be a lot more efficient. The last starting weight was 225 pounds. And this next time, since I'm going to add some mileage, it'll be probably around 250 pounds starting weight on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, we used to take the carts, and we had these, I don't know what the hell they were. They were, you know, custom made things, and we'd actually double up on the wheels on both sides, like a semi does, you know. So like an 18 wheeler, you just have two sets of tires right up next to each other on one side, two on the other. That way, if one goes, you can just keep on moving. The operation doesn't stop. And you're right. You can totally Gucci it out so that you've got, you know, all your bladders, and you can have just endless water coming directly to your mouth, you know, and connect it all together. Yeah, it's super cool. I love that stuff. And I'm guessing, you know, leading into the next question, if you at the when you're on poles and you're going to either, you know, whether it's the North Pole or South, it's the same concept that I don't think people realize is you've got a sled behind you full of gear and you're just pulling it, right?
I tell you, it really is. It's, I mean, you hit it on the head, is that the setup might be a little different because when we're on the poles, is we have like a harness with a rope, and you're dragging a sled behind you. And in just the way that I've personally set up my desert cart, like I said, it's more like a rickshaw where I'm standing inside of it and I've got a bar across my hips normally in the front.
Yeah.
But other than that, conceptually, it's the exact same thing. And when I did the desert crossing was actually before my first polar experience at the South Pole. So really what I utilized was what I learned on Denali, because Denali it's similar. It's kind of a cross between a mountain and a pole in the sense that you're carrying a heavy backpack, but you're also pulling a sled behind you. Mm. So a lot of the systems that I learned there is I just applied it to the desert, and, you know, it worked out as well as it could have in that time. And now I've got a lot more experience since then. So now I know changes that I want to implement when I do the next crossing.
Yeah. Damn. That's cool. I'm getting all excited here and jealous at the same time.
I'm just laughing your comment about you know, making the card all Gucci. Cause I know you're geeking out on it. When I was flying home in my mind, I was writing down all the things I wanted to do, and I was just redesigning the cart in my head.
Hell yeah.
I was getting excited about it.
Well, as you know, now with solar, like you can really, I mean, take advantage of, you know, power in different ways. You can have that, all the different panels on top of your gear, charging all that technology that you need to support you and never have to carry a battery, you know, like, cause that used to be the one thing that would weigh down. Like, let's say if you're the comms guy, you know, the comms guy's carrying the radio, and then he's asking everybody in the platoon, hey, will you carry two extra batteries? Everyone's carrying two extra of these big ass, you know, heavy ass batteries that, by the way, you can't get wet because they're lithium and they'll just catch on fire or blow up or burn you. But anyway, yeah, now with solar and, you know, you could Gucci that shit up and be all kinds of rock star out there in the middle of nowhere by yourself.
Exactly, by yourself. Yeah.
All right. Let's see here. Training. So now, obviously, maybe once you get going on this path, you just kind of keep going. But there had to have been a point where you laid a solid foundation in your human performance so that you could do all these things. Do you have a recommended, you know, diet and like workout that you favor more than others? Or how did you get to the point where you could pull all this off?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. So in my background, I was always strength and power. Is I played, you know, high school football, college football, then played a little bit of pro ball. I had a couple contract offers to play pro ball, which I left. You know, I quit playing in my early 20s. Then from my early 20s to my late 30s, I was still somewhat of a power athlete. Even though I wouldn't call myself an athlete, I was focused on power. I was just big squats, big deadlifts, which I enjoy lifting heavy stuff. So really, I had no endurance background whatsoever. Mm. And transitioning into this at 39 years old into such a high level of endurance took a tremendous toll on my body. And I really had to learn how to train for that because you can't use the same approach you do for strength and power. So with that, I set up a program where it was zone training, where for me, it was zones according to different heart rates.
Yeah.
And so whether I want to use, you know, like a zone one, zone two, which is like, you know, utilizing fat for energy and just increasing cardiovascular capacity versus a zone three, zone four, which is more power output, is kind of how I, you know, put the training program together. about 90% of the training was done in a fasted state. So I would eat, you know, the night before at maybe 8 o'clock, and then I'd train first thing in the morning, and I wouldn't eat again until like noon to two in the afternoon. And I may go out and train between, you know, 2 to 6 hours, you know, completely fasted like that to get my body to recognize that it doesn't need external carbohydrates, that I can utilize food as, or the stored fat as fuel, which is a tremendous benefit. The only time that I would eat before a workout is if I was doing, say, a high intensity cardio workout, like a zone 3, zone 4, or if I was hitting a big leg workout where I needed, or like maybe a 100 pound pack carry up a steep hill, where I really needed those carbs and that energy. And that was a tremendous benefit for me. On average, I would train about 20 hours a week. So from August 18 to our kickoff of March and 23rd of last year, was 30 months. I trained 2,076 hours over that period. So a little, roughly about 800 hours a year. So it was definitely a full-time program. And lastly, with regards to the diet, it's mainly I would just eat a very clean diet about 6 days out of the week. I'd have one cheat day. And on a cheat day, I can eat anything and everything that I want to. But I was burning so many calories that, I mean, it really didn't matter. And then, you know, protein is about 1 gram per pound of body weight. Fat is about 0.75 grams per pound. Then I'd fill the rest in with carbs, depending on how much energy I expanded during the day. And it's just the last thing I'll say about it is the one of the toughest parts was the weight loss. Because when I kicked off going to Everest, I was 202 pounds. When I first started my training, I was 242 pounds. So I had to pull off 40 pounds of a lot of muscle. And that was difficult, you know, to do. But it just, you know, that fasted cardio just does wonders.
Yeah. So what you explained to me is intermittent fasting, which then led to that kind of ketosis state. And right. I'm sure you just got freaking ripped once it engaged. And then I'm kind of curious, going from the 240 down to close to 200. I mean, did you get rid of all the mirrors in your house before you did that, or what? I mean, because that could play a role with your ego, right?
It's funny you're joking about it. I still struggle with that to this day. I hate to admit it, but I'll be totally honest with you. Is that I've got, like, in my closet, I've got my fat clothes and my skinny clothes and then kind of my intermediate clothes. But I'll go to put on a shirt and I'm like, what the hell? Is this my dad's shirt? You know, and it's when I was, you know, 230, 240. And, you know, going from an XL to a medium, it definitely messes with your mind. But you know, the only thing that makes me feel better is what I can do now in any of these activities. You know, when I was 240 plus or even 220 plus, I couldn't, there's no way in the world I could have even kept up anywhere close to what I can do now. So that helps a little bit, but my ego still is a little fragile over the whole matter.
Yeah, I bet. I'm the perpetual skinny guy my whole life. So I know exactly, like, you know, once I was able to actually put on weight, I was like, oh my God, thank God. Finally, it was like when I hit, you know, 45 years old, I started actually gaining weight. And I was like, oh, finally, I feel so much better. And I can actually look in the mirror and not be disgusted with myself for being this anorexic looking freak. But
I know how you feel.
And yeah, it's just how it is, you know.
The worst part is going into the gym and trying to move big weight, you know, like on a squat or a deadlift, where hell, there was about a year and a half that I didn't do a bilateral squat. And now it's stuff that I'll max out with now, I used to warm up with before. And that's a big ego.
Oh, yeah.
Big ego pressure right there.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. The bar ain't bending anymore when it goes on my back. You know?
Well, if it makes you feel any better, the bar never bent when it went on my back. So I stayed away from the heavy stuff because I was like, you know, I had a bird frame. I was going to break. We will be right back after the break. All right, let's see here. Yeah, this is all good stuff. So, yeah, that's quite the training regimen. And, you know, I love hearing about that kind of stuff because there's always something to learn. What were you, before we leave it, your favorite protein? Is it like salmon or what do you find yourself eating the most of?
Yeah, no, it's really what I favor and what I suggest to a lot of people is pasteurized egg whites.
Oh, okay.
So basically liquid egg whites, you know,
yeah.
And you say that to a lot of people and they always give you the same kind of gross look on their face. I'm like, look, if you're making a cake, you're using eggs in it. You're getting more flavor, you're getting more texture, you're getting all this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's eating, whatever, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 calories a day, especially clean, is not easy to do.
No.
And after a while, I get tired of cooking and I get tired of eating. You know, I get tired of chewing. I feel like a cow because I'm just chewing all day.
Yeah.
So it's what I found is that it's I'm a protein shake connoisseur. I mean, I am a master when it comes to protein shakes. And instead of using water, is I just mix in 25 to 30 grams of liquid egg whites. And that's, you know, it gives you better flavor. You get, you know, egg albumin, which is arguably some of the best protein that you can possibly have. It's pasteurized, so you're not cooking it, destroying the proteins. So that I love. And then if I'm going with a shake, is I tried to get away from dairy and whey and all that kind of stuff. Mm. So I use typically a carnivore based shake, where it's an actual meat based shake, you know, rather than a whey based shake. Then in addition to that, it's mainly a lot of turkey, some chicken, some bison. And I'll be quite honest with you, the reason I eat that is because it's cheap and I'm frugal on fronts, and it's fast and easy to cook. If I had to sit there and cook fish and cook all these things, I don't want to take more time out of my schedule to do that. I can just, you know, get this stuff put together, choke it down and move on with my day.
Right. You're strictly looking at it as, hey, this is fuel in order to perform, and it doesn't matter what it looks like, tastes like, yeah. I don't care. I'm just eating it. Yeah.
When it comes to me and food, it's strictly fuel, and I don't care two ways after that.
Yeah. Now back to the shake with just egg whites. You're putting ice in or something else, or is it just gooey?
No, what I'll do is I'll do, for example, the one I just had before this was 25 grams of pasteurized eggs, so liquid egg whites.
Yep.
25 grams of iso whey, so whey protein isolate. One scoop of raw oatmeal that I just grind up in there. And then I did 28 grams of MCT oil.
Oh.
And then with a couple strawberries and then some cinnamon to help with insulin regulation.
Huh.
And then I don't use any ice in it. I've done room temperature shakes for years now, and I want something that I can just, you know, grind up and slam down and get on with it. So the ice kind of slows me down in that regard.
But that doesn't sound very liquidy.
No,
it sounds like a shake.
Yeah, right? What you can do is if it does get a little bit thicker, is you can just put a little bit of water in it on top of it.
Okay. Got it.
And put it down and yeah.
Yeah. I was just imagining the egg whites and oatmeal combined together. Like, that still sounds a little thick.
No, it really does. It depends on the ratio. If you get the ratio right, it's not bad. But if you need to, just put a little water in there. But another great thing to do is that you can take that same recipe, put it into like a little, like a Tupperware dish, throw it in the freezer for about an hour, and it turns into a nice little pudding.
Huh.
So if you want something just to change it up, but the same content, is I eat that pudding. I'll make that pudding a couple times a week as well.
Nice. Man, I'm going to have to try that out now. Okay, yeah. Cool. Love it. I like fast, easy, just get to the point. I'm like you in the sense I don't want to sit here and cook all day just to fuel myself so I can go burn it later. It's like, no, I want just get it all in and let's get it over with, you know?
Yeah. Now, look, yeah. I can tell you what I'm having every meal of every day, you know, a week from now. It's generally the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's one last thing I got to deal with.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same. Like, I'll have salmon, broccoli, and rice every meal. I don't care. That's fine. Yeah. I'm fine with that, you know? Okay, shifting gears. Now,
sorry.
We're going into rowing across the Atlantic. So you already did this, right?
I just got back from it, right.
Yeah. So, okay, how did... let's start with the vessel itself. What were you using?
So we had it was a partner and I, we had a 22 foot boat. So it was basically it was an open cockpit ocean rowing boat. So on one end, if you took an egg and kind of elongated it and then scooped the center of it out, is essentially what it looks like.
Okay.
So on the forward is that we've got a cabin that was about 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet living space. So a very, very small cabin.
A prison cell. Smaller than a prison cell.
Yeah, it's a lot smaller. It's a lot smaller than a prison cell. Then there was a crawl space that was under the boat that went to our automatic water maker. So if you wanted to lay down in the cabin, you'd lay down and put your legs down a crawl space. The issue was there was the rowing positions. There were two of them, you know, one in front of the other. So if you put your legs down the crawl space to lay down, the guy outside rowing is now rowing on top of you. Is kind of how it was. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And the way that we worked it is once we left the Canary Islands is we rode 24 hours a day. So we put together a schedule. We each had six shifts that would range from 1 hour to 4 hours. So the average, you know, obviously is 2 hours. So I would row 12 hours a day. He would row 12 hours a day. And we just did that, you know, until we hit Guadeloupe in the French West Indies.
Damn.
Yeah.
So if you're in the middle of rowing and half of my row stroke is hovering above my buddy, right? And I need to urinate. Are you guys peeing on yourselves to keep speed moving forward, or how does that work?
No, it's a great question. We had a bucket system on board. So we had two buckets. We had a blue bucket and a black bucket, and the blue bucket was for cleaning and laundry. The black bucket was the bathroom bucket. And just the key was not to confuse those two. So anytime you do your business is you'd get up, you'd walk into the deck, which was only 10 feet away. So the entire time, linear feet was about 15 feet that we lived within. And I would say maybe 95% of our time was within probably a 4 foot, you know, radius. For 53 days, I didn't travel more than 4 feet, you know, 95% of the time. So it was definitely an interesting experience.
Yeah, I bet. And I'm guessing you didn't use red lenses at night, because then you wouldn't be able to tell which bucket's what, right?
Sometimes white you just lens. Gotta take a chance. Yeah, just take a chance. Sometimes.
Yeah, white lenses all the way. Got to make sure I'm grabbing the right bucket here.
Yeah.
So Nin, your buddy, you must have picked someone you've known, you knew you could get along for, you know, 50 plus days at sea together in a very confined environment. I'm guessing, right?
That's a great question, and the answer is actually no. Is I'd met this cat for 30 minutes one time before the trip. I'm serious. So a friend years ago in 2017, when I climbed Aconcagua for the first time in South America, I met a guy there. He and I became friends. He had rowed with the partner that I just used on Atlantic Crossing years before that. So, this individual is based in Paris. So a couple years ago, I was traveling through France, met up my buddy. He's like, hey, let's meet the guy that I rode with. And this was before even Dawson's Peak was even in my mind. Mm. So I met this guy for literally 30 minutes. And then years later, when I came with Dawson's Peak, I was like, oh, maybe you want to throw an ocean row here. I'm like, well, I know this one guy. So I hit him up and asked him if he'd like to be a part of it. He said yes. And, you know, we had a great time together. Honestly, we had no arguments. We had no issues. It's just our personalities were very similar, but very different. So it was the perfect complement, you know, to each other.
Huh, man, yeah. You got lucky on that one.
I got extremely lucky because it's as you know, with all the things that you've been through, which are far in advance of this, it's a very challenging, stressful, taxing environment where it really brings out the true character of someone who they really are. But he and I got along great, and I really couldn't have asked for a better partner.
That's pretty cool. As soon as you said he's in Paris, you know, that I was waiting for you to say, and he didn't speak English, so it worked out great.
Well, yeah, I think his English is better than my French, but his English ain't great. So that probably did help.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny is you got two guys on such a small boat, but I'm telling you is we talked for maybe 10 minutes a day. So we would talk in passing. So when he was rowing, I was in the cabin and vice versa. When we would switch, we'd give each other an update on, you know, here's the wind, here are the waves, here's the speed, here's whatever. We'd say, okay, then you'd go into the cabin, shut the door, and the other person would be out there for 3-4 hours by themselves. So we didn't really talk that much. It was interesting.
It sounds like the perfect man environment where you just don't have to talk much.
Yeah,
that's most of the dudes I hang out with. You know, we say our, you know, we get away with saying, What is a typical guy's requirements? Like 500 words a day, and a woman is like 15,000 words a day.
Like 500 still sounds like a lot to me.
That does. It does. Yeah. I mean, even just this conversation's already gone too damn long. All right. So I see something like next adventures here. I see Australia. Is Australia in your future?
Yeah. So the last mountain that I need to finish off the Grand Slam. There's actually two options depending on how you define a continent. So there's two lists that you can do. You either do Mount Kosciuszko, which is on Australia proper, or you do Karstens Pyramid, which is in Papua New Guinea. So what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to do both of them. So Indonesia is currently open, but the region where Karstens Pyramid is not open. So as soon as that opens, I'll pop down there, climb Karstens and Kosciuszko. And that leaves then just the North Pole, which will probably be next April, you know, unfortunately, because of the delays to finish off the Explorers Grand Slam.
Yeah. And are most of these solo, or you got buddies, or are you hiring guides? How are you kind of negotiating these things?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Is that so on probably just under half of them is I'm using Ryan Waters, who's a good friend of mine. And he has a company called Mountain Professionals. Ryan was the first American to complete the full length Explorers Grand Slam. So I think he's summited Everest 6 times now. So just the guy's just an absolute stud, been a mentor of mine when it comes to mountains and poles. So whenever I can, I climb with him, but on 3 or 4 of them is I'm going just with me and a guide. As you probably know, on a lot of mountains that you have to hire guides a lot of times, you know, to generate, you know, local business and for a variety of reasons. So I personally like to go just with a guide, you know, when I can and to stay out of the team environment.
Yeah. That way you just accomplish the task and not worry about navigation and this and that. I mean, I'm sure you're keeping that stuff in check, but it's less stressful when you got someone who's done it already, you know, hundreds of times.
It is. And it's also less stressful for me is not being on the teams you know, this, preparing for this has been a full-time gig. And I mean, I've poured everything that I am into it. So when I show up is I want people that have committed as well to surround myself with. And for example, when we just did Elbrus this year, when I first summited it a couple years ago, it took me like 8 days, 9 days. This year I went back, we did it in about 22 hours. And we actually did more climbing than we did the first time. And you can't do speed like that in teams. Right. And we did the same kind of rapid ascent on Aconcagua and also on Kilimanjaro, which you simply can't do, you know, having a team around you.
Yeah. Yeah. I know the feeling. And it's nothing down against, it's nothing against a team environment. It's just the reality is reality. You're only going to move as fast as, you know, the slowest person. And there's a lot of other, you know, one piece of gear times, let's say an 8-man team, that's 8 opportunities for that piece of gear to fail for that person, which slows everyone down exponentially.
Yeah. 100%. And look, I completely agree with you. And I'm glad you clarified that.
Yeah.
When it comes to teams, if you're on the right team, surrounded by the right people, you will be so much more than you could ever be as an individual.
Yeah. You'll crush it.
There's no question about that, but it's about finding the, you know, the right people in the right environments, you know, at the right times, which doing what I'm doing, just unfortunately, I don't have that opportunity. So like you just said, to eliminate as many potential points of, you know, issues or concerns, that's why I like to climb, you know, typically just with a guide where we can just, you know, go ahead and bust it out and get out of there.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt, man. That's just a whole lot faster, a lot more economical and efficient and probably fiscally sound. Okay. So going a little bit further backwards, cause I don't want to move on until we at least touch on your military time, right? It's important to note you were in the Navy and it looks like you were at the Naval Academy for a little bit of time.
I want to be very clear about that is that I don't claim to be a veteran in any way, shape or form.
Okay. Yeah.
I've got, you know, a ton of friends are a lot of family members. So I was at the Naval Academy for about a year and a half, completed, you know, plebe summer, plebe year, played football there, all that kind of stuff. And then at that time, I really wanted to fly. And as you know, when you're getting recruited by coaches, they typically tell you everything you want to hear. And but my eyes just weren't good enough to fly. And so once that became evident that I was going to be probably put on a boat, because at that point, I'd already had multiple surgeries that I – as much as I'd wanted to go special forces, my body probably just wouldn't hold up for it. Yeah. So I wasn't going to be a SWO. They weren't putting me on a boat, you know? So I was like, if I put me on a boat or in a sub, I can't fly and I can't go special forces. So I unfortunately, I got to depart at this point.
Yeah. So. Wow. That's unique, right? I mean, people that go to, you know, any of our military academies very rarely move on, or, you know, kind of go, I'm going to go over here instead. Right.
Yeah. I tell you, man, it's probably, you know, somewhat similar to your times in the teams, is that every day at the academy is a bad day. It's just a bad, tough day.
Yeah.
It's just like then there's just different levels of bad days. But it's, you know, the time that I spent there, as difficult as it was one of the most special times in my life. I made, you know, just tremendous friends, and just really put into perspective, you know, about, like what you said, especially about working in teams.
Yeah.
And about performance, and about attention to detail, and about, you know, dedication and sacrifice and commitment. And you're surrounded by just such an incredible group of men and women, that many of which go on to serve in the armed services. And it made a very, very big impression on me. So I'm extremely grateful for that opportunity.
Yeah. Well, I never experienced that because I was just a scumbag enlisted guy. But, you know, I've heard plenty of stories about you ring knockers. So then you went, I mean, you didn't really step down. You kind of stepped up. I mean, you know, if you took military education versus University of Pennsylvania, I'd say at least you moved upward. And, you know, that's a school, it's Ivy League. Most people, I don't think, know that. And it, you know, it's, let's see. Yeah. Benjamin Franklin started that thing. That's why it's an Ivy League school, right? Yeah. Something like that. You can probably tell me more about that.
Yeah. So I transferred to Penn in Philadelphia. So like you said, University of Pennsylvania, not Penn State.
Yeah.
Is that, and then I attended the Wharton School of Business, you know, which is where I graduated from with a degree, and also played football there at Penn for just over a year. But actually, I had to undergo another surgery, leaving Navy and going to Penn. So that kind of unfortunately restricted my college football days. And, but, you know, Penn was interesting. I learned a lot. I didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoyed the academy. It's just such a different environment, but, you know, I tried to make the best of it and got out of there with a decent education.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I can read between the lines on that comparison.
Did I say that well enough?
Yeah. Okay. That was very politically correct. Yeah, I love it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just was a little different, you know, no big deal, but I got through there and moved away as far as I could. Never looked back.
haven't been back in 20 years.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome, man. You're obviously a smart guy, and even tougher, or maybe really dumb guy and really tough. I don't know, both of those, but that's a great set of stories, information, knowledge, experience. I loved every minute of it. But now we got to move you into something that'll probably be the hardest thing you've ever done in your entire life. Okay. And that is to see if you can survive this podcast. You're listening to Can You Survive This Podcast? Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. Now, I haven't looked at your scenario today, so we'll be going through it together. And it'll be as much a surprise for me as it is for you. So let's see what, are you ready?
Hopefully it's something like The Hangover in Vegas, but we'll see how this rolls.
That's a good idea. We'll have to throw one. Yeah. We do have some diehard scenarios. I don't know which one you're getting today, but we'll see. Okay.
Bring it on.
Your hypothetical survival scenario. For this scenario, you are on the mountain, a mountain. Okay. Not for one of your world records. You're just, you know, having fun going down the slopes. Okay. And look at you. I see that you're taking notes.
Is that all right? Yeah. About Gene here. Yeah. We're supposed to see that. Yeah.
All right.
I have a team of advisors off camera as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go.
Make sure he's always looking good. Make sure he's always looking good. Okay. You are going down a less traversed part of the mountain. Okay. Because you're a risk taker, you know? So you're going those paths less, what's that saying? Less
road less traveled.
There we go. You're the smart one. Okay. It's a little more dangerous, but, you know you can do it. So first question, do you A, choose skis, or B, choose a snowboard to do this?
So let me ask you this. Is there snow on the mountain?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, as far as I know so far, yes. I'm going to say
listen,
yes.
From what I know about your personality right now, I might be in the desert. And you're like, hey, I never said there was snow. So,
you're on it. I like it.
I see it, Clint.
Yeah. There we go. Yeah. So yeah, as far as I know, for right now, yes, there's snow.
Okay. Listen, I don't want to ask a million questions to try to overqualify everything. Just going on what you told me.
Yeah.
I would take skis.
Skis. Yeah. Is that because you're just better on skis than you are a snowboarder?
Well, you know, it's that on a mountain, I'm actually better on a snowboard, but I think, you know, not knowing the terrain and everything, skis just offer a little more versatility.
That's right.
I can do a little more functionality on skis.
So not knowing your future, you're picking skis. Right. Exactly. Good job. Well, both answers were, there was no right or wrong here. So it's right. Good job. So now you've selected, you know, going down on skis, and you're about to hit the slopes. Okay, so next, do you do a dummy check and make sure you did not forget any supplies you may need, or B, hydrate with a little water and just hit the slopes because you're a risk taker? Why not?
No, I'll definitely do the check because I've been in those situations where I'm 100% sure that I have X, Y, or Z. And I get to where I need it, and it ain't anywhere to be found.
Yeah, so, it's 100% lost, right?
So I've done that a lot, and you know, tying back to that training question earlier, is I normally train in a dehydrated state, so water's not normally a big concern for me anyway. So I'm definitely doing the check.
Yeah, we are a lot alike. I used to make this joke about how I'd always drink Cokes and eat Twinkies because I wanted to train my body to worst case scenario.
Hey, man. It's funny because when I go out and I train, like I said, I train fasted and I train without water because it's like you're going to get in these situations and I can't say time out. I need to eat a Snicker bar and drink a Coke.
Right, right.
And so if I'm going to be in that situation, maybe 26,000 feet up a mountain, I better start preparing for it, you know, when I can control the environment. And that's kind of, you know, how I look at it. It's been my approach.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I don't know if it's the smartest, but hey, it works. I'm still alive. All right. So... yeah, you make sure you've got all the supplies. You check and double check because that's definitely the first rule of safety to ensure a successful trip. And one of the items you grab is an avalanche transceiver. I'm sure you're familiar with these.
Yeah.
So do you A, attach the transceiver to your body, or do you attach the transceiver to your pack? So A or B, body or pack?
Right. I'm taking that thing with me on the body because I've seen a number of packs get ripped off and there's no telling where those
Correct.
Things have
yes,
ended up.
Exactly.
So I'm keeping that's
that, a, that, that is what I call a life support item, right? So you want it on your body, which in the military we call first line gear, right? Anything that touches your clothes touch your skin. Those are all, so anything you can put in a pocket, anything you can just, that's all first line gear and it should always be life support. So that when everything else is gone, you still got it. Okay, good job. So now, as a rule of thumb, you attach it to yourself, not your pack. So now you're getting down, you're going on the slopes, okay? Now it's time to have fun. You're heading down the mountain when, of course, an avalanche occurs. And a wall of snow is gaining on you from behind. Now, we're going to just pretend everything is in slow motion right now because we know that if it was coming down from behind, you probably don't have any more time. So in slow motion, do you A, compress yourself, right, and become like this little aerodynamic ball so you can get down the slope faster, or B, make your way to the flanks as quick as you can?
Yeah, it's if I understand the question correctly about the slow-mo is, you know, you ain't outrunning an avalanche. So I would try to get, you know, to the flank as best I could. Yeah, I'd try to find something to get behind. And if I couldn't, then I'd try to get in a position where I can brace myself and put myself in the best position to, you know, get hit and receive the avalanche.
Yeah, you're dead on. And I'm sure when you've done a lot of these different adventures and challenges, you're constantly thinking through these scenarios, aren't you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we're always work to get that we're always working on when you're out there is, you know, looking at the points that are going to be potential issues about, you know, where the rocks can come down, where there's an overhang of snow or ice. If something does happen now, where am I going? Like, where am I out? Am I going forward? Am I going back? Am I jumping off the cliff? I mean, and sometimes you don't have a good option, but you have a better option.
Yeah.
And you know, they may all be bad options, but it's sometimes you got to take the better of the bad.
That's right. Kind of like our presidents, right? You just got to pick the better of the bad. Yeah. All right. So let's see here. It's a massive snow. You're not going to outrun it. And so, yes, heading to the flanks is definitely correct. And you want to get yourself as perpendicular to the travel of that snow as possible. Right. The massive snow is about to come rushing by you. You've kind of answered this already, but do you A, jam your ski poles into the ground and try and stabilize yourself, or B, grab onto a nice big tree?
Yeah, I've worked with people, I think they would answer this both, or, you know, on both sides of the fence. Personally, is I'd try to get behind something, because if I can get behind that tree, hold on to it, maybe that can take some of the force. Because when you're talking about this much snow and ice, mm-hmm. you get as jammed in as you want to, but odds are you're not going to be there, you know, for very long.
Yeah, it's concrete coming at you, right? Yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to elude it, even behind a tree, behind a boulder. I mean, but yeah, I the right answer according to this is, you know, grab a tree, get behind it, leverage it, because stabilizing with your skis, I think, you know, now you're limited to just your own strength and the stabilization of those fancy, super lightweight skis, ski poles you have. So, you know, though they may be strong, they're probably not strong enough to go up against a avalanche. No. But once again, for listeners, you know, people who do this for a living, they can actually take and risk certain aspects because they know what they're doing once something happens. They've thought about it, they've gone through the scenarios and stuff. We try to give you the bigger, more general answer that hopefully helps you, or at least you know, but hope you never have to use. Okay. When the oncoming rush becomes unavoidable, grabbing onto a solid fixture will obviously help. So next, do you A, ditch your pack, skis, and ski poles and any excess gear, or B, tie yourself to the tree using the straps of your pack? Yeah, kind of go with your gut though.
Yeah, so the option is I get to the tree and either I just take all the stuff off and just let it go wherever it's going to go,
right?
Or attach myself to the tree,
right?
It's if I had the time, is I'd probably try to get attached to the tree and then try to attach the stuff, you know, to me, because I don't know where I am. I mean, if I'm 50 miles away from anybody and now I'm out there and potentially injured, and then plus I don't have my gear and it's, you know, 100 yards, a couple hundred yards down the hill or completely lost, and the situation just went from bad to a lot worse.
Yeah, so you kind of, yeah, you answered it right and then added. So getting all of that drag, or, you know, all those extra items that could potentially get caught by that rush of snow and end up dragging you, like your pack could easily be the reason why you get dragged down the mountain. Yeah, taking it all off is number one. And I like what you just added. Attach it to the tree so that at least you have something, or the hopes that you have something once this thing passes.
Exactly. Not to me, but if I could attach it to something to where it's just not a total yard sale, you know, all the way down the mountain.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Yeah. So ditching the gear and attaching tree. Correct. I love it. That's a great add. The rush of the snow becomes too strong. So now you lose grip on the tree, of course. You're, you know. So do you A, try to climb the tree, or B, get big and kind of get into a swimming motion and try and stay on top of the snow the best you can?
Yeah. If I understand it correctly, it's already hitting right in the midst of it.
Yeah.
That's what's taking place. There's no way I'm getting up that tree. Yeah. So I'm going to body surf that thing and see what I can do.
There you go. And I've read a lot of information, been through some enough training, and I know these things probably change. I do not know what is the current. Have you gone lately and they, you know, experts say it used to be, you know, try and stay on top of the snow, put your feet in front of you as if you're going down a river. Feet right. first, right?
That the last that I heard, that's what I was told to
yeah.
do.
Okay. Yeah, I know things change rapidly with safety and security. So as you, you know, quote unquote swim with the rush, it starts to become overwhelming. So do you A, keep your arms at your side, or B, put your hands out in front of you, in front of your face? pretty obvious.
It's I definitely get my hands out in front of me. The issue that you're gonna run into is if you get all kind of balled up, is you can very easily get caught in that position, and that snow is so heavy, and you can be in such an awkward position that you may not be able to, you know, get your arms away from you, you know, once you finally come to a stop.
Exactly. You just nailed it. That's exactly what we're leading into. You want to get those hands up. One, you know, the last thing you want to do is get knocked unconscious and then suffocate. So keeping your hands up, almost like combatives, you know, protecting your head the best you can. Remember, you're in the middle of like violent chaos here. And then it also allows you to hopefully enable and keep yourself conscious, and then allow yourself to breathe and start using your arms to hopefully help yourself in some form or fashion. So yeah, if you're buried in the snow, moving or breathing will become very difficult. Like you said, by placing your hands up front, will allow you to create a makeshift air pocket, if you will, near your face, so that you can continue breathing at least the air that you have for that point in time. It's come to a stop. All right. So do you A, dig in the direction of your head, or B, use your senses and determine which way is up?
Yeah, that's a good question. From flight training, I know how easy it is to get disoriented, have spatial disorientation. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're going to dig in the direction that you think is up, I'd be shocked if you get that right in the first couple tries. So yeah. I'd probably go direction of my head, even though I don't love that answer. That's probably what I'd do.
Well, yeah. Senses and head is tough. Senses, you know, after that, you know, could be something as simple as if the snot is running up your forehead, then you're probably upside down, right? In some form or fashion. So, you're looking for gravity to help you, whether it's the tears in your eyes, the snot coming out of your nose, your breath. You want to take all that stuff into account and determine which way is up. I remember a long time ago, I read in a book, you know, it's like, use your lighter, right? And then light it. And then the flame, you know, depending on which way the flame is going, right, is up. But the problem is how do you get to your lighter, right? You know, unless you already had it in your hand or easily accessible, then it's pretty tough. But yeah, if you could get to a lighter and light it, then the flame is going to go automatically, you know, up.
And that's obviously assuming that there's some type of you know, cavern or space around you. What I'm kind of envisioning in my mind is that you are completely impacted in snow, or you're not moving. You know, it's difficult to move anything.
Right. You know, and the snot is frozen as soon as it comes out.
I mean, you know, it's interesting, and this is certainly not to put a downer on this, but this is a very real world scenario. Mm-hmm. Is that a friend of mine that I was just with in Antarctica, we climbed Vincent together. He came back when I went to the South Pole, and 3 or 4 days after I saw him, he died in an avalanche skiing.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, where he was skiing, and there was a small avalanche. He got taken off course and ended up upside down in a tree well and got stuck there and couldn't get out. So this is something that is very serious, and it happens. And like I said, it literally happened a couple months ago to a friend of mine.
Yeah, that tree well scenario, that is, I can't think, that's, I mean, imagine if you were still awake. I mean, did they determine if he was conscious the whole time?
Yeah, they didn't know that or not, but I think I know the direction you're going with.
Yeah.
Going with it. And it's just, to me, it's just, I don't use the word terrifying very often, but to be, you know, upside down, covered in snow, stuck in a tree well, is a pretty terrifying scenario to imagine.
Yeah, and no one can find you, you know.
Right.
It's just horrible. And for those of you listening, tree well is a natural, almost like hole, if you will, around the perimeter of a tree where there is no snow, because the limbs and the branches and the foliage basically protects the ground around it. So snow will build all the way up, you know, but there'll be this cutout around the tree trunk. And if you fall in those, especially upside down, it's almost impossible to get yourself right side up. Right. Did I explain that right?
No, you explained it perfectly. And it's just, those things can be 2 feet deep. They can be 10, 12 feet deep. So I mean, these things can be real, you know, real challenging.
Yeah. Damn. That sucks. And that's a trained, experienced guy.
Well, hell, he still owed me $20 too. So, I mean, it sucks for various reasons.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Just write his mom. Say, hey, yeah. that fucker owed me money, man. Come on. All right. So you're conscious. You have a little bit of you have a little bit of movement because you found yourself, because you went to the flanks, you ended up in looser packed avalanche fallout. All right. Let's just say that. And so do you punch an air channel from into the direction in which you think gravity is going, or try to get upside down and try and move your body around into the direction of which way you think is up?
Yeah, in that scenario, I'd probably punch the hole, given that I don't know how long I've been under or what I've been through. And I would think that, you know, getting that oxygen in and would probably be my primary concern.
That's it, man. You survived this podcast.
Hey!
And now that serves as a safety sustainment and refresher training for you. So you can check that off the box next time you're...
Can I get a certificate in the mail with that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're now qualified to go to the North Pole once the Russians stop being dicks, right?
Yeah, right.
All right. Well, hey, man, that was awesome. Good time. Now, where can people find out more about you and the ecosystem of all the great stuff you have going on?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking. So our website is just dawsonspeak.org. So everything that we're doing, you can see on there. You can see a short sizzle reel, which gives you an overview of Project 7 for Soldiers. Learn a little bit about, you know, the organization, you know what we're trying to do, you know, my personal history, Project 7 for Soldiers. And also there's a timeline on there of the projects that have been complete or the events that have been completed and in what's upcoming. And then also we're most active social media wise on Instagram, and that's just at Dawson's Peak as well.
All right. Well, I'm going to go follow you right now. For those of you listening, if you're unsuccessful finding Matt Dawson or any of his foundations online, just go my Instagram page, check out who I'm following. It's not very many and they're only cool people. So, you can find Matt there to make it easy. Otherwise, dude, you know, thank you for coming on. I love everything you got going. I wish I could go do these adventures with you. That'd be kind of cool.
Listen, I appreciate it. And again, with Project 7 for Soldiers, anybody that wants to get involved, 100% of the net proceeds are going to the Gary Sinise Foundation and Hope for the Warriors. So I'm not making a dime on this. My organization is not making a dime on it. And these are two groups that do absolutely incredible work. So as much as people could help that, is going to really help them even, you know, benefit more people.
Awesome, man. Thank you, Dawson. I appreciate you coming on board and good luck and be safe out there, buddy.
Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it.
And like I always say, keep it simple because crisis will complicate the rest. Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.